Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmateksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Searching for Certainty. Are You Certain? By Lama Kathy Wesley. Fear and anxiety appear to be part of the human condition. We spend a lot of our lives searching for certainty about our plans, our futures, and our purpose in life. The Buddha speaks to us from a place of absolute certainty, from the state of awakening itself, and encourages us to follow. This talk will describe the Buddhist journey of certainty and how we can pursue the same path. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karmateksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, everyone. It's really lovely to see all of you today. I want to apologize for tardiness. I was delayed doing some prayers. It's lovely to see everyone today. It's great. Yeah, hi. Boy, this is a good crowd today. Thank you. I know it's unusual, but I'd like, even though you've already been sitting for a minute, I would like to sit for a minute, if everybody's okay with that. Just to settle a little bit and put the week behind us a bit. I decided that I kind of had a busy week, a little bit of stress. I don't know if you guys can relate, but I decided that it was wear a Hawaiian shirt to work day. So technically, they said that we could wear a shirt that was white. What is it? White, blue, red, yellow, gold. They didn't talk about aqua. And they didn't talk about design, but here we are. So in any case, let's just sit for a minute and let our mind come to rest, and then I'll give a little bit of a talk. Okay, thanks very much. I call that the pause that refreshes. And if you know that reference, you're older than I am. Okay. Let's start with a prayer. On the front side of this is the refuge prayer. And you don't have to recite it, but if it's something that you're familiar with and you'd like to recite, you can recite it along with. And if not, you can kind of join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session to all goodness for all beings. We'll recite it in English two times, and then I'll recite it once in Tibetan, and you can join in if you know it. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly, most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Omoy Sanje Chudon Soji Chonahamla Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin Soji Bei Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Okay, thanks very much. And I'll recite one short prayer of my own and then we'll begin. Oye Polden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chiwar Pede Tinchula Kadrin Jembo Gone Che Sun Te Kusum Tugging a Drup Sal Dusso. Thanks very much. So this is very cute. I brought the wrong book in with me. That's a good one. But I do have my notes, so we're good. I wanted to talk today about a topic I have discussed before. I have talked about this topic in the past. But I wanted to mention it again because I just feel that it's something that will help us put all of Tibetan Buddhist practice into some kind of logical context. Because when you come into a center like this one, you hear about the practices we do, you learn quiet sitting meditation to calm the mind, you learn compassion meditation to sort of open the heart, and you hear and learn the chanting meditations, such as the Om Mani Padme Hum, compassion mantra. You hear those. Nice shirt, by the way, sir. I'm just now seeing the Om Mani Padme Hum shirt. Thank you. it's wonderful. Which is a way of praising the name of Avalokiteshvara, or Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who was so brave. He was so brave that when he generated the wish to attain enlightenment, like the one that we spoke just minutes ago, when he first generated that wish, he said essentially, although not in these words, I vow to stay behind until samsara is emptied. And that's a lot of bravery. I'm gonna stick around until he's gonna be the last one to turn out the light on samsara. And that's a lot of courage. And so it takes an incredible amount of courage to be a bodhisattva. And I'll be talking about that in my next talk. But if you look at all the practices we do, quiet sitting, compassion meditation, and mantra meditation, you might say to yourself, how do all of these fit together? How do these fit together? How do they process us as individuals? What do these practices do to us and for us and with us as individuals? How's that work exactly? I have actually had many people ask me this. So I'm going to say a couple words about that. And what it has to do with the title, which is The Search for Certainty. The Search for Certainty. Many of you who are familiar with Tibetan Buddhism are familiar with the translations of some of the Tibetan meditation manuals and texts. And certainty appears in the title of several of them. You'll see there's a text that I'm familiar with called The Torch of Certainty, or The Torch that Illuminates the Path to Certainty. And sometimes if you've read the Mahamudra meditation manuals of the ninth Karmapa, one of them has certainty in the title, the ocean of certainty, or true meaning. So Certainty seems to be a thing in Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism. But why is it a thing, and why are we seeking it? I'll tell you my view, which comes from the years that I've been practicing meditation myself and teaching others meditation. I think that meditation helps us to gain certainty that we are seeking every single day of our life. We want to know what's going to happen, and we're kind of upset that we don't know what's going to happen. We wake up every morning, and we don't really know what's going to happen that day. And we might actually be a little worried about it. Like, is something bad going to happen today? Is something good going to happen today? Will I face some challenge or difficulty, or is somebody going to give me a hard time today? And because we cannot see the future, we cannot see what is coming, there's a little bit of anxiety and worry that comes with that not knowing. Of course, as we're growing up, we learn this really quick. Anybody who has or has seen a two-year-old know how this works. A friend of mine who is a Buddhist teacher said, when you're two, that's the first time you discover that the world is not going to give you what you want. Somebody says no to you, and you don't like it, because that's not how it's supposed to go from your point of view as a child. So in this way, she said, our heartbreak with the world starts when we're about two and we find out that the world might not turn out the way we want it. And then after that, it's just one thing after another, isn't it? You can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this and you can't do that. I feel sorry for children, I have to say. I mean, no wonder they cry sometimes, you know? No wonder they cry. They have zero power to determine their future. And they have all of these other people making decisions for them. I feel for children. And when they become teenagers, they find out that they have some of their own power. And then they try to use it, and then, of course, often they'll get squashed. I don't know about your growing up, but when I was a teenager and rebelling, it didn't work out so well. But when we get our freedom from our families of origin and we're out there on our own, independent in the world, we find out we still don't have power. It's kind of depressing, because we spent all those years in school thinking that when I get out of school, I'm going to have power. I'm going to be able to take care of myself. I'm going to be able to do what I want. And don't you know, same thing happens. Same stuff, different day. So we lack knowledge of the future. We are not given to know the knowledge of the future. We don't know it. And because we don't know it, we feel a little anxiety. There are some people for whom not knowing the future, they love it. In fact, they're a little bit kind of good with it. These are the people who, you know, jump out of airplanes with parachutes on, and scale very high cliff faces. You know, they're the people who just, they don't mind what's going to happen and the possibilities. But for many of us, uncertainty bothers us. We want to know what life is about. And at a certain point in our adulthood, or our youth or our young adulthood, we will begin to ask the question, what's it all for? Why do I want the power to determine my future? Why do I want to carry out these things? Why do I want to engage in this career? Why do I want to have this family? Why? And over time, we get the capacity to ask ourselves these questions. What's it all mean? What's the purpose? What's the meaning of life? What's the purpose of life? What, what can I be and what can I do? And this was precisely what led Prince Siddhartha to leave home. He lived in a very wealthy home. He grew up with a father who was called king. He had it good, but he had this nagging feeling that there was more to life than wealth. He excelled in his education. He excelled in his practice of martial arts. He excelled in every single way. He was a great athlete. He married young and had a family. He was successful in every way you could think of it. But he decided one day when he finally got the tour of his kingdom that he had been asking his father for, he saw the suffering of his people. He saw sickness. He saw aging. He saw death. These are things that were strange to him. And he began to ask, what's it all for? What's it all about? And the questions drove him to leave his family in the care of his father and stepmother and undergo years of seeking. So he was seeking certainty as well. He wanted to know for certain what life was for and what life was. What was this life? And after 6 years of practice in the yoga tradition, he had really excelled at yoga too. Yes, he excelled in everything he did. And he excelled so much that everybody called him the great ascetic because he didn't eat very much, didn't drink very much. He was always sitting in a still posture, but his mind was still unsettled. He didn't have certainty. He didn't know what his mind was. And so after doing all of those exercises, all of the yogic exercises, the mental ones and the physical ones and so forth, he still wasn't any closer. So he decided to switch gears and try a different technique. He left asceticism behind, just like he left the wealth and the luxury in the palace. He left that behind too. He left it all behind and walked into uncertainty. He walked into the unknown. And so he ate a meal. People say it was sweet rice and milk. After having not eaten for a while, that was, it was nourishing, let's put it this way. And it refreshed his mind so that he could then begin to look inside himself and to see what that mind was. And in that period of meditation, could have been hours, could have been days, he gradually and more and more gradually, having left behind luxury and deprivation, settled in a middle path of contented meditation. And in that contented meditation, looking at mind itself, he discovered certainty. He finally knew what life was for. He knew the purpose and meaning in his life as well as the lives of everyone. He was so stunned by his discovery, he sat in silence for hours. It might have been days. Not sure what to say to anyone about it, because he had discovered what we would call the nature of mind, the true nature of mind, beyond philosophy, beyond theology even, the nature of mind. He saw it and knew it and was it. And it is said then that the legend says that one of the Hindu gods asked him if he would please teach on what he had learned. But it could also have been just the person passing by, noticing this striking individual. Whoever it was who asked him, when they said, "Would you please teach us what you have learned?" That was when he began to teach. And he taught, as we talked about just last week, the Four Noble Truths. Was it last week? I thought it was week before last. We talked about the Four Noble Truths. He described how life is. He said, there's a lot of suffering in life. That's the first truth. Suffering is part of life. You can't divorce yourself from it. You can't pretend it's not happening. You can't decide to offload it to somebody else. You know, it's not something you can kind of like give away. It's yours, and you have to learn to work with it. That's the first noble truth. Second is that suffering has a cause, and it's not the neighbor, it's not your folks, it's not the person next door, it's not the boss even. It's actually our own fixation. We want the world to be a certain way. Remember the story of the two-year-old? I think we're still in there somewhere, wanting the world to turn out our way. And so in this way, we cause a lot of our own suffering by fixating on things and wanting things our way. And so the Buddha said the cause of suffering, some people use the word desire is the cause of all suffering, but I like clinging because it sounds more willful, you know, mine. And so this clinging and fixation is actually behind all of our suffering. We can't just sit still and be. It's something that's not in our wheelhouse just to sit and be. Because we've got these brains. And I'm telling you, having a brain like this is pretty amazing. I mean, we went to the moon as a human species, but we're also destroying the planet, so there's that. Human brain's pretty smart. But anyway, and we still can't go beyond our fixations about the differences between us and other people. I like that person, I don't like that person. You know, I want this, I don't want that. I mean, it's weird, and here we are. So there are a lot of things we can't get past as individuals and as societies because of the things we fixate on, most of which are not true. It's really hard to be human, it really is. So what the Buddha is saying is suffering's part of life, and part of it comes from within, actually all of it comes from within ourselves, that our own fixation and clinging cause our suffering. But the good news about that, that's the third noble truth, is that because there is a cause to suffering, there is also a solution. Because if something is caused by something else, that cause can be unmade. That cause can be unmade. And that leads us to the fourth noble truth, which is the path that shows us how to go beyond suffering. It shows us how to let go. I mean, because, you know, you can't say to a person who's suffering, just let that go. I mean, that's it. That doesn't make sense. It's not being truly present with a person to see them suffering and then say, just let that go. It's like it's that easy. We have to find a way to be present with them and help them as they work through what's going on with them. So for us as human beings, you know, it's a difficult thing. But because of the fourth noble truth, we have the potential to find an end to suffering and to come to a state of happiness. So the fourth truth is pretty easily stated as do no harm, practice virtue, and tame your mind. And do no harm means don't hurt yourself, don't hurt others. Practice virtue means take care of yourself and benefit others. And tame your mind means to meditate and look within yourself and see what the true nature of everything is. And so that brings us around to certainty again. When we sit and meditate, we actually experience our mind differently. My teacher, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, who passed away a few years ago, he used to say that it's really important to teach people to meditate really early on. And he said the reason for this, he said, is because, he said, if they meditate, he said, they don't have to intellectually believe or understand anything of Buddhism. He said, it's really hard. Buddhist philosophy and teachings are a little hard for people here, he said. But he said, so just have them meditate. And when they meditate, they will actually experience their minds differently for just a moment in that long period of meditation, which may be struggle. I don't know about you guys, but for me, I still struggle a little bit with the techniques of meditation. But he said, just for a moment, they'll experience their mind differently, and then they will have confidence that what the Buddha was saying has some merit to it and has some truth to it. And gosh, he was right. Because that's why meditation is the main thing we teach here and the main thing we do here, because it helps us to experience our mind differently. And that's the first meaning of certainty for many of us. That's the first time we gain some certainty, is when we actually experience our minds in meditation, and it's different. It's not the usual rigmarole. It's not the usual strangeness and pain and suffering and difficulty. It's not the usual stuff. That's where certainty starts. But it doesn't end there. We don't come to the full knowledge of certainty at that moment. But we've become interested. We're ready to say, maybe there's something to this. And that leads us into further practices. So shamatha shows us that our thoughts are discontinuous, that there's actually gaps between our thoughts. When one thought ends before the next one begins, there's unclaimed territory in the middle. Unclaimed territory. And it's not bad. It's not bad. It's kind of good. And we learn how to let go of thoughts. And when we learn how to let go of thoughts, the hidden benefit of that is that we learn how to interrupt thoughts that are troublesome. We learn how to interrupt them. And not only that, on the other side, we learn how to generate thoughts that are more healthy for us and more helpful for us, and that help to support the view that we've come to understand by just resting the mind. So that's the second stage, the stage of compassion meditation. Quiet sitting shows us how the mind kind of works. And then compassion meditation, we imagine as we breathe out, we imagine we give goodness to all beings on the out-breath. It's a very simple practice. Just imagine that all goodness and so on flows to all sentient beings on the out-breath. And if you are feeling particularly strong that day, you can imagine is when you breathe in, you can imagine you remove suffering from other people and from yourself. And that because of your pure motivation, all that suffering dissolves into nothing and disappears once you've taken it. And by doing this sending and taking meditation, this compassion meditation, we train ourselves to have a different habit. It's no longer about the two-year-old who wants everything, right? It's no longer about that anymore. It's about who we could be. We may not be able to be Avalokiteshvara, who said he was going to be around until the end of samsara to turn out the light. We may not be that brave, but we can begin to change how we see ourselves and how we see other people. And so that's the second level of certainty. When we see that training the mind in love makes a difference for us. It makes a difference for us. When we train in having a mind of love for other people, strangely enough, we have started having some love for ourselves. And the right kind of love. The love that understands when we make mistakes and tries to correct them. And the love that means we won't beat ourselves up on the head with an invisible stick when we do something wrong. The understanding is that we will have some caring for ourselves, as though we were the older sibling we had wished we had. A lot of people have older siblings, but some of those older siblings were not the person they really needed to have. So I mean, it's no wonder children invent imaginary friends, if you know what I'm saying. But from the point of view of our own minds, if we can train ourselves in love for ourselves, then that's going to help us to love others. So this is another level of certainty, because we begin to get an idea of what life's about. Life is about love. Life is about generosity. It's about being stable in our actions, stable in our thoughts, stable in our words. It's about being a person who others could rely on. Being there and showing up for ourselves. There's an openness of heart that happens at that level of training in certainty. We begin to know what life is all about. I remember specifically the moment that happened for me. I was talking with my husband one evening after work, because I used to work a regular job like everybody else. I was a newspaper reporter. Remember newspapers? That was a thing. And I'd come home from work and I'd do my Buddhist meditation. And one day I said to my husband, I said, you know, after having taken the Bodhisattva vow and vowed that I'm going to practice love for myself and others, I said, it's a little creepy. It's almost like my life doesn't belong to me anymore. It's like it belongs to everybody else. And at first that kind of made me sad, because I was going to do stuff with it. You know, I mean, I had ideas, you know. I was going to do stuff with it. But then I realized that being able to practice love toward myself and others and have my life not really belong to me anymore took a lot of pressure off of me. I no longer had to please everybody else, honestly. Serving others doesn't mean you have to please them. Serving others means you have to develop that heart. And that's a better way. My dad, who always was giving me great slogans and advice from the recovery tradition. It's like, thank you, Dad. He would talk about having this heart that was so big that it could welcome everyone, you know. So this was the kind of feeling I had when I realized at first my life didn't belong to me anymore. But then I said, you know, that's not bad. I don't have to have all those expectations on me now. I can just be what I am, and that is going to be enough. And certainty, that's another form of certainty. But there's one more form of certainty. I've talked about the certainty that comes from the shamatha practice, the certainty that comes from the compassion meditation practice. But what about the certainty that comes from the unity of shamatha and vipassana? Everybody here knows about the word shamatha. It means calm abiding. It describes the calm abiding meditation where we observe the breath as it comes in and goes out and we let go of thoughts. It's a training meditation to learn how to let the mind just be. But many people, it takes them some time to learn about vipassana. Vipassana, or as one of my friends calls it, vipassana, I don't know how the correct pronunciation is, it means insight. Insight. Here in this tradition of Buddhism, in fact, I can't wait till you can see pictures of the shrine we're going to have in this space under these lights. We're going to have a beautiful shrine, and the central figure is going to be the Buddha Shakyamuni as he appeared to the Indian Saint Talopa in the form of the primordial Buddha Vajradhara, and how he taught him the most simple form of Vipassana he could possibly teach. They call it Essence Mahamudra, and it is being able to look directly at the mind and see its nature, see what it is, fully, completely, decisively. And that is the kind of insight that is meant by the word Vipassana, insight into the nature of how this mind is and what this mind is. And until then, until that moment, when we reach what is called the first level of bodhisattva awakening ourselves, until then, we're going to be searching for certainty, and we're going to continue to search for it in all kinds of places, some of them healthy, some of them not healthy. When I worked for the newspaper, one of the strange things I thought about was the horoscope. I mean, you know, I know astrologers, and I know how cool astrology really is. But then you read the horoscope that is popular writing, right? And it doesn't, and it just says, something might happen today. And you go, yeah, that's right. And you know what I noticed in my office? Okay, so I'm sorry, I'm going to go sideways here for a second, but then I'll come back to certainty. When people were starting a new relationship with friends, they would read their horoscope more. I don't know if you've ever known this to happen to anybody that you know, but so, you know, you fall in love with someone and then suddenly you're really worried about something. And so then you read the horoscope every day. What's today going to be like? And so on. So as a result of that, we almost worry more anyhow. But when we talk about practice, meditation practice, that's where certainty begins for us, and the right kind of certainty, not the certainty you get from reading the newspaper or the internet or anywhere else. The certainty that comes from within us as individuals, the certainty about knowing who we are, what we are, and what we are capable of and what our purpose can be. So that was what I wanted to say about certainty. I have a couple of quotations, and I think then if you've guys got questions about certainty, about meditation, about anything really. I won't tell you where I got my shirt, but I will answer most any other questions. It was from a thrift shop in Saskatchewan. Okay, so I didn't go personally. It's a long story. But I'm going to read you a couple of quotations about certainty. Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche, who is the filmmaker, he said, "Fear and anxiety are the dominant psychological states of the human mind." How does he know us so well? "Behind the fear lies a constant longing to be certain. We are afraid of the unknown. The mind's craving for confirmation is rooted in our fear of impermanence." Yeah, that was one of the basic teachings of the Buddha. Everything is composite and is slowly falling apart. Dzongtsar Khyentse continues by saying, "Fearlessness is generated when you can appreciate uncertainty. When you have faith in the impossibility of these interconnected components remaining static and permanent." I'm going to read that part again. When you can appreciate uncertainty, when you have faith in the impossibility of these interconnected components remaining static and permanent, At that moment, you will find yourself, in a very true sense, preparing for the worst while allowing for the best. It's a type of reality. It's a type of reality we can all use. My second quote, and the last one, on certainty. This one's from Dujum Rinpoche. It is said that if you do not meditate, you will not gain certainty. If you do meditate, you will gain certainty. But what sort of certainty? If you meditate with a strong, joyful endeavor, signs will appear showing that you have become used to staying in your true nature. It's like a relaxation. Dujum Rinpoche continues, the fierce, tight clinging that comes from dualistically experiencing the world will gradually loosen up, and your obsession with happiness and suffering, hopes and fears, and so on, will slowly weaken. After a time, your tense, dualistic attitudes will evaporate, and you will get to the point where gold and pebbles, food and dirt, gods and demons, virtue and non-virtue are all the same for you. You will be at a loss to choose between paradise and hell. Oh my. However, until, I know, he was quite the man, Dujum Rinpoche. However, until you reach that point, while you are still caught in the experience of dualistic perception, virtue and non-virtue, Buddha fields and hells, happiness and pain, actions and their result, all of this is your reality until that time. But after that, after certainty is gained, then we have a completely open life, and we're open to whatever, and we're actually ready for it, whatever it is. And that allows us to help people in a way that we wouldn't be able to help them before. We couldn't help them before. It gives us more power to help people in ways we never could imagine. So thank you for going on this little journey with me, searching for certainty. I've been wanting to talk about this for a while, and when I saw these two quotes, I said, well, those two quotes probably could be the lecture, but I, you know me, I can't not say something. So it's discussion time, and the discussion microphone is open. Thank you, Hayes. Yeah, so you can walk up, and if anybody else wants to ask a question, you can stand at the back and so on. Johanna is first, and if you'll be second, sir, we'll have you in what is called the second seat. Okay, thanks a lot.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And namaste to everyone else.
Good morning.
And I am so glad to see such a wonderful outcome of visitors and renewed members. From my experience, yeah. The pandemic has caused such turmoil in so many people's mm-hmm. lives, and the fact that there is now chaos mm-hmm. in the world, especially with mm-hmm. Russia and the Ukraine, mm-hmm. as well as refugees. Mm-hmm. And some time ago, I myself had tried to give hope to people who were having difficulties. But because of the pandemic, there became such isolation, and I found it very hard mm-hmm. to get through even an hour of the day. And I just want to say I rejoice as far as everyone who is here today, because we have such allowance to be able to gather. Mm-hmm. However, for myself, I'm still grieving as far as what has been going on. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to really resolve that. Mm-hmm. And I'd appreciate any feedback from mm-hmm. you on this.
Okay, yeah, I understand. You can have a seat too. Yeah, that, there you go. Boy, I really appreciate your the way you've articulated it. You've articulated it very well, because I think your experience is similar to many of our experiences. Not everyone will have had the same experience during the pandemic, but the one thing I heard you say that really meant a lot to me was that even in the midst of that difficulty, you had moments where you could reach out and help other people, and that was a satisfying thing. And I understand, because I feel the same way about the sadness I feel with the world being the way it is right now. I think that with all of the pressure we as human beings have put on the earth, that the conditions are changing, and because conditions are changing, we're becoming unsettled within ourselves. And this is, I think, where warfare and disputation and all of those horrible things, people hurting each other and so on, I think that's a lot of where it comes from, is that there's more and more pressure on us because of the mess we've kind of made here on the earth. But I think that what you said at the very end, that places like this provide a home, a refuge, a framework for people to enact their best intentions, to carry out their best intentions. And I remember the great Bodhisattva saint, Fred Rogers. I mean, right? You can't go wrong. He said, when the world is sort of coming apart, he said, look to the helpers. Place your confidence and faith in those people who are able to, even if all they can do is just call a friend. That's the thing, he said, that will uplift you and let you know that at least in your part of the world, the part that is circling around us individually, there is some goodness there and some stability there. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because in Tibetan Buddhism, you've seen like the paintings that are called mandalas. They're squares, you know. This room is actually a mandala of sorts. It's not, you know, it isn't mathematically correct, but it's, you know, we gave it our best. It's a pure realm, right? And the meaning of the word mandala is center and surrounding. And so we are at the center of our own individual mandala. And if we can make a difference in our own individual world, and enough people do that, there will at least be a place like this, a place of relief. The world may still end up falling apart, and it very well could be that we can't stop that. But we're doing the best we can to let our world remain a world of safety and peace within ourselves and the circle of people who we're supporting and helping. And so, to me, that's where I draw my strength from, is the fact that we have this community here and that we can help each other. But I don't know that we're going to be able to stop the wars individually, and I feel badly for that. But we can at least stop the war that's happening within us. So I really appreciate your question, and I wish I had better news, but... But here we are. We're here to support each other. But thank you for that question. There's another question here.
Hello. This is my first Dharma talk in person instead of virtually, so I'm very happy to be here. Thank you so much for the talk today.
No, thank you.
My question is about certainty that you're describing. Would you say that it's knowledge, like part of wisdom, or would you say it's part like awareness, experiential, if that makes sense?
Yeah, actually it does. I may end up answering you in slightly different words, but the three words you've said do have meaning and they do relate. Awareness and knowledge and wisdom. Okay, awareness, knowledge, and wisdom. Those are the three I heard. Did you say any others?
I think that's it.
Okay, very good. So I think it starts, for many of us, it will start with knowledge. Figuring stuff out. It will, seeing a framework for a description of the mind, you can read about it. You can read a description of the framework of the mind, and you can understand that. That's the knowledge part, right? And you can also get knowledge when you learn the techniques of meditation. You can learn the techniques, right? So that's the knowledge part. Knowledge can lead us to certainty. And then there's also the awareness part and the wisdom part. The wisdom is sort of like the end point where we actually achieve certainty. We'll call that certainty. And awareness is a way of talking about the mind. I'm going to use awareness perhaps differently than you meant it in your question. But, you know, hopefully it will be illustrative of how knowledge and wisdom come together. Knowledge is about the technique. Wisdom is about letting mind just be what it is. Awareness can be a tool to understand how the mind really is. Because as the great meditation master Mingyur Rinpoche, when I asked him what awareness was, he said, "Oh, awareness, that's easy." He said, "Do you see my hand?" And he waved it in front of my face. I mean, I was as close to him as just beyond the desk. It's like really close. He does this, and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm aware of that. I see that." He said, "Do you hear this?" And I said, "Uh-huh." He said, "That's it." He said, "You are aware of what you see, you're aware of what you hear, and you can be aware of that awareness. And in that way, awareness itself can gradually, with proper instruction, become a tool toward wisdom, toward you can be practicing being aware and being aware of awareness, you know, practicing that, again, with proper guidance, because otherwise we might get it one moment and then not get it the next moment. That's kind of how meditation is. But if you've got good guidance in how to do your meditation, then awareness can be a doorway to certainty and wisdom. But you have to learn how. You have to learn how to apply it, both on your seat and then when you're in your everyday life. And I feel it should be informed. All of your practice of meditation is best when it's informed by love and compassion. Because if it's just about, I want to learn something, that can become competitive. Like, I want to learn more than that person, or I want to be smarter, or you know what I mean. It's like some people even compete against themselves. You know, so I feel like that's why love and gentleness is important to practice in meditation. So when you're sitting and meditating and you have a thought, some people kind of get a little irritated and annoyed. And they start taking that voice, you know, in their head. But what I tell people is try your best to take a different voice. Try your best to be gentle and to say, it's okay, you're just going to come back now. Just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. Right there. Like my friends in 12 Steps say, just keep coming back. It's a different meaning of coming back, but you get the idea, right? So I don't know if that helps with your question, but it allowed me to use those three words in several complete sentences.
That was very good. Thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, we can talk more about it. This will be the last question.
I want to start last week, the teaching was on the seven branch prayer. And so for anybody who doesn't have a copy of it, would like one, I made some copies and brought them, and I'll put them on a chair by the door. You can pick them up as you go, as you leave.
That's great, thank you.
And on the back side is the Lojong, daily Lojong practice by Lama Kathy Wesley.
I appreciate that, Tim.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You've got a customer right here.
I do. Instant popularity.
I love it.
I'm a big fan of uncertainty. So, because to me, what's certain is that the future is unknown. And so being receptive to whatever comes up is, to me, is uncertainty. And I loved the end of that first quote about preparing for the worst and being open to the best, something like that.
Isn't that amazing? He says, you will find yourself in a very true sense preparing for the worst while allowing for the best.
Well, that allowing for the best to me is intentions, aspirations, and preparing for the worst is the ultimate form of unattachment to the result of that intention. So that's how I try to live my life. But being open to the future is, trusting in the future, and is, to me, is preparation for our ultimate entry into the bardo. So, because I really don't know what that's going to be like.
They have a guidebook.
They have a guidebook.
for those who aren't familiar with the word, with the vocabulary. Thank you, Tim. By the way, I'm glad you came today, Tim. That's great. Because that Johanna, Tim, great questions. And the gentleman who, I don't know your name, but thank you. Those are all good questions. Yeah, there you go. See, this is it. So I'm just really appreciative of your being here. And in terms of, for those of you who don't know the terminology, the word bardo, which is B as in Bill, D, B A, R as in Richard, D as in David, O as in Oliver. Bardo. Bar means middle, and do means like to go. So the idea is bardo is the middle, the going through the middle. It's like a middle period of time. And there are many descriptions of what bardo is, but most people are familiar with the Tibetan book of liberation through hearing in the bardo. Sometimes it's known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And so many people are only familiar with the description of the dying process and the after-death process that are in this set of literature. But there's actually also a bardo of living, and here we are. And so in each of these places, you can learn and be liberated from suffering through the practice of meditation. So thank you for mentioning that. And so that's what I meant when I jokingly said there is a guidebook. Well, we're going to have to stop here today, but I want to thank all of you for coming here today and bringing your sincerity to us, because that's what I think is like the best thing about having a place like this. People bring their sincerity here. They bring it here, and they sit and meditate here in sincerity. They bring it here, and they practice here, and they leave the goodness of their intentions here. And that's what I love about it. So let's gather together all that goodness and dedicate it. Another Buddhist thing to do. Dedication of merit is on the back. We'll gather together all of the goodness from this session and mentally dedicate it to those who are suffering right now, whether it's from the pandemic of illness or the pandemic of disturbed minds and violent actions. All of these, may we all be free from this and come to awakening. In the well, it's interesting about this prayer. The first one, it says, by this merit may I obtain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. That's what's really interesting. In Buddhism, the enemy is actually our own negative actions. I just think that is so cool. Okay, and sorry. All right. We gather together all this and pray together.
By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. I'll sit quietly for a moment for the final dedication, resting the mind. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.